home and the Browns and others who have been gone and some who are visiting with us. We're happy that you're here. We hope that you'll feel free to study with us, take out your Bibles, and follow along in the things that we want to talk about in our study this evening. We're studying the subject of Bible authority, and it seems that it's the crux of a lot of problems and divisions that exist among those who profess to be, at least, servants of the Lord. And if we can nail down this subject, I think that it'll help to resolve a lot of issues, not only among brethren, but issues that we might confront when we're studying Bible principles with those that we come in contact with from day to day. I think one of the greatest problems that we have sometimes is remembering where the Bible says such and such. We may be able to quote the verses, but to find where it's located, often that becomes a handicap to show somebody else, here's what the Bible says. And we don't want folks just accepting that we say, here's what the Bible says. We want to be able to show them, and here you can read it for yourself. So as a result of that, we've tried to emphasize from the beginning of our study, learning where certain passages are. And there's one that we began the study with, which says, as the chief priest and the elders of the Jews came to Jesus, and they asked him, by what authority doest thou these things? And who gave thee this authority? Now, if I were to ask you, Katie, where is that passage, you would tell me? Matthew, that's very good. Matthew 21, verses 23 through 27. Jesus responded to that question with a question. He said, the baptism of John, whence was it? From heaven or from men? Indicating that there was only two possibilities by which John baptized, either the authority of heaven or the authority of men. They replied to Jesus in a kind of an interesting way. They reasoned among themselves and said, if we say that John baptized by the authority of heaven, then he'll say, why didn't you believe him? But if we say that John baptized by the authority of men, then the people, we fear the multitude, for they all hold John as a prophet. So they said to Jesus, we don't know. Now, we might quibble about whether or not that was a lie. I think they did know the authority with which John baptized, but they refused to tell Jesus because of their own reasoning. If I wanted to ask you, David, little David, where do I read about Cain and Abel initially? Yes, sir. I read about that in Genesis chapter 4. And I read about Cain and Abel, at least Abel, in the New Testament. Where do I find that? Hebrews 11:4. That's right. Very good. If I wanted to read about Nadab and Abihu, Julie, two Old Testament priests, the sons of Aaron, who offered a strange fire unto the Lord, where would I turn to? All right, Randy, help her out. Leviticus 10, verses 1 and 2. That passage is important because it illustrates men who went beyond what God said. The Bible tells us that they offered a fire unto the Lord, and it was considered a strange fire because the Lord had not told them to do that. They offered it, but they offered it without authority. Now, we might step out on thin ice sometime and fall through because we act on, well, without a premise of thus saith the Lord. They offered a sacrifice that the Lord had not told them to offer. And so consequently, they were consumed with fire. If I wanted to read about a certain king by the name of Saul, Bruce, who was told to utterly destroy the Amalekites, and he brought them best of the Amalekites back to offer a sacrifice, where would I turn to? First Samuel 15. Joe, if I wanted to read about another king by the name of Uzziah. Now, King Uzziah was an interesting character, as you recall. He wanted to burn incense unto the Lord. But when he went in to burn incense unto the Lord, the priests who were authorized to do that, they weren't there. And so King Uzziah presumed that he would do that because, you see, the priests weren't there. And number one, where do I read about that and what happened to him? No, it's in the Chronicles. Joey? 2 Chronicles 26, yes, beginning about verse 16, that's correct. And what happened to King Uzziah when he presumed to offer incense unto the Lord? He became a leper, that's right. Now, in all of these illustrations, we're learning something. And that is, we can't just assume that certain things are acceptable before God just because they look good to me, Jonathan. I need a passage on that. That's it. And?
16:25.
That's it. Both of them say the same thing, that there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. Now, one of the things that we've noticed in our study is that whatever we do, in word or deed, Emily, whatever we do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. What passage teaches that? All right, it's Colossians 3. Now what? 17. Colossians 3, 17. That's pretty good. Colossians 3, 17. Now, to do anything in the name of Christ, Carolyn, means what? By His authority. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of or by the authority of the Lord. Now, that means I can't look to myself. I have to look to what He says. Now, how does He speak to us, Randy? Can I look into the Old Testament prophets and read there, and that's how He speaks to us? In other words, do we burn incense because the Old Testament priesthood was authorized to burn incense?
Can I answer with Scripture?
That's what I would prefer.
Hebrews 1, 1 and 2.
All right.
God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom He also made the world.
All right, God today speaks to us through His Son. He doesn't speak through the Old Testament prophets anymore. There was a time when God spoke in different amounts, different ways, through the prophets, but He don't speak to man anymore that way. He speaks to us today through His Word. Now, I'm going to guess that most every one of you in the assembly tonight has a Bible, don't you? We call this a Bible class. It's a good idea to bring one, and if you didn't, there's one in the pew or nearby where you're sitting. God doesn't speak to us. God doesn't speak to us in some still, small voice in the night. He speaks to us through the revelation of what we have right here. Not the Old Testament. Now, we read and study the Old Testament. We've talked a good bit about it tonight. But God speaks to us not through the Old Testament prophets, but He speaks to us through the New Testament, through His Son, Hebrews 1, and that's what you just read in verses 1 and 2. How do we know that He doesn't speak to us through the Old Testament, Carolyn? That is today. Mm-hmm. Okay. Who does remember the passage? All right. Danny? Daniel, I'm sorry. All right, Hebrews chapter 8, but it doesn't mention the schoolmaster aspect. Hebrews chapter 8 does tell us that we're not under that system. What passage mentions that the old law was a schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ? Joey's looking at the ceiling, so I know it's up there. What? David? No, that one also helps us, but that's not the one we're looking for. That tell Galatians, and I thought you didn't know where it was. Galatians chapter 3, verses 20 what? 24, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 will be the context that we want to look at in that. All right, very good. And there's another one that you can tell I'm barking for, and that is the transfiguration of Jesus. Where He went upon the mountain, remember? When He went upon the mountain with Peter, James, and John. Matthew 17, 1 through 5. And while they were there, Moses and Elijah appeared there with Jesus. And Peter said, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If Thou wilt, we'll build three tabernacles, one for Thee, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And as Peter said that, a voice came out of the cloud and said, This is My beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye Him. Now, what does that say about hearing Moses? Do we hear Moses today? No. What about the prophets represented by Elijah? Do we listen to the Old Testament prophets today? No. This is My Son, God said. Hear ye Him. Now, does that mean we ought not study from Moses or the prophets? Oh, no. Valuable lessons to be learned. Randy, Romans 15, 4.
I was just going to say Matthew 5, 17 is kind of a companion.
Okay, all right.
Do not think that I came to abolish the law of the prophets. I did not come to abolish the people.
All right.
He fulfilled those prophecies.
He fulfilled them. And once they're fulfilled, that doesn't mean you can't turn to it and read it anymore, but it's no longer a responsibility. No, no. Now, that's right. Second coming. Now, when we talk about Romans 15:4, it tells us the proper use of the Old Testament text. How do we use the Old Testament text?
The things written before were written for our example.
All right.
Pretty much learn not to make the same mistakes they did.
All right. Exactly right. They're written for our learning. We can turn to those things and learn a great deal, so that we don't do the same things that they did. Now, in our study tonight, we're talking about something that's quite popular in the denominational world, and it's quite popular even among the churches of Christ, and creates problems and has divisions. And we want to talk about the social gospel yet a little bit more. And the social gospel means very simply that practices are engaged in that provide social and recreational activities. Social and recreational activities. Now, in our study, we've examined arguments that are made to try to advocate that the church can provide social and recreational activities. And we've taken the position that that's not the obligation of the church. Homes may provide social or recreational activities, but the church has a very definitive work to do that is different from the home. The church has a responsibility in the realm of evangelism, in the realm of benevolence, in the realm of building up or edifying its own. And we do not find authority in the New Testament, that is, in the name of Christ, for the church to provide social or recreational activities. Now, what we've tried to do is to examine some passages that folks try to use to defend the social gospel position. We've looked already at Acts 2. We've already looked at Acts chapter 20 and examined the context of those. I want us to turn in our Bibles to Jude verse 12 and 2 Peter chapter 2. Now, in our last study, we did get to talk a little bit about Jude verse 12. I want us to look at it just briefly and then go on and talk about 2 Peter chapter 2, because both of these passages use the expression feast of love or love feast, and it helps us, I think, to examine what these were. All right? Jude verse 12, describing these false prophets, Randy, I think you identified that from verse 4 in our previous study. Describing these false prophets, verse 12 says, "These are they who are hidden rocks in your love feast when they feast with you. Shepherds that without fear feed themselves, clouds without water carried along by winds, autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots," and it goes on to describe them in some detail. But the point that we're looking for is to talk about these love feasts. They're described as hidden rocks in your love feast. There are those who have taken the position that what these were was some kind of a social get-together. Now, we want to talk about that and see if indeed there can be any authority established for that kind of definition. Now, while we're there, by the way, I should turn back and read the text of 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. 2 Peter 2, verse 13. Again, describing false teachers, even from the first of this chapter, says at verse 13, "Suffering wrong as the hire of wrongdoing, men that count it pleasure to revel in the daytime, spots and blemishes, reveling in their deceivings with you while they feast with you." Now again, this is recognized by some as being authority for the church to provide social and recreational activities for those in the community and for the membership. Now, Thayer uses this definition to talk about these feasts of love or love feasts. Now, Thayer, as you well know, is a well-accepted dictionary of Greek words, a lexicographer. I want you to notice what he says. He says that these love feasts, or agape feast, as it were feasts expressing and fostering mutual love, which used to be held by Christians before the celebration of the Lord's Supper, and at which the poorer Christians mingled with the wealthier and partook in common with the rest of food provided at the expense of the wealthy. Now, I want you to look carefully at this dictionary definition. You know, one of the things that's always helpful, if you're not real sure what a word means, get out the dictionary. But be careful that you examine the definition given in the dictionary. See to it that you examine it to get what the writer is saying. Don't supply your own definition. Now again, these were feasts expressing and fostering mutual love, which used to be held by Christians. Now if we just stop right there, we would have the social and recreational aspect that some claim today, wouldn't we? But that's not what Thayer says. He says that this feast was something that was done in connection with the observance of the Lord's Supper. Now question, those who want to practice these so-called love feasts as simply a social and recreational gathering, and appeal to Thayer's definition. Is that Thayer's definition?
No.
John?
Wouldn't Thayer's definition be in contrast to what Paul had said in 1 Corinthians 11 as well, though?
Yes, we're going to look at 1 Corinthians 11. Yeah, some recognize Thayer's definition, at least this portion of it. This portion of it to be the defining answer to 1 Corinthians 11. But it is not. We're going to see why in just a little bit. Okay? You have that look. It's still working on it, huh? All right. Well, what I'm trying to do with Thayer's definition is to show that what some practice today is not what Thayer defines the word to mean. Thayer defines it as a supper or a meal in which those who are poor are provided food at the expense of the wealthy. Now, question, is that what's being done by those today who advocate the social gospel? No, that's not what's being done. So we need to take Thayer's definition and just throw it out the window if we're going to practice what folks practice today. That's not what Thayer defined. Joey? He's like Webster.
He's not an inspired writer.
Exactly.
There's a chance that he's in error.
Yeah. We're going to look at other definitions.
But anyway, it says before the celebration of the Lord's Supper, is there implying that the love feasts were part of the assembly? I'm not sure if he is or not.
Thayer is implying that. Albert Barnes, and we're going to look at his definition in just a moment, prominent, I believe, Presbyterian theologian, as it were, he takes the position that the love feast was, in fact, the Lord's Supper. That it was, in fact, the Lord's Supper. It had nothing to do with any kind of eating food together. It was the observance of the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine. And we'll see the evidence he offers in just a moment.
But that text right here that we're looking at is separating the difference between the Lord's Supper and also the feast and coming together.
That is true. Yes. That is true. It's separated. It's not the same thing, according to Thayer. Albert Barnes makes it the same thing. So what we want to do is look at an accumulative group of lexicographers and dictionaries and come to our own understanding of what these were. But I want you to notice this portion of it. It was a meal that was provided by the wealthy for the poor. Again, I ask the question, is that what the so-called common, quote-unquote, fellowship meal in the quote-unquote fellowship hall is today?
No.
No, what's being practiced today is very simply, if I may use the quote, fun, food, and frolic. Randy?
Well, the only exception would be when churches have a big turkey fest for the homeless on Thanksgiving.
Okay. But that's not what's being practiced.
No.
Right. That's not what's being practiced. All right, Bruce?
Also, for today, not only is it, it's also collecting money and funds for an expense for the church.
Okay, well, that's true. The church winds up funding this. That's true. Well, I want to look at this next definition. Everett Ferguson. Now, where he came from and who he wrote for is significant to our study. I want you to notice that he was a professor at Abilene Christian College. Now, most of you may, or some of you who are older, David. Got you, did. Little David, there you go. Tell me about Abilene Christian College.
It's a Church Cross College in Abilene, Texas. I think it had something to do with Harold Hazel. He was there or something.
Okay. Well, see, you're old enough to remember a little bit about that, aren't you? Well, you're right. It is and has been a Church of Christ college. And by that, I mean churches of Christ have in time past supported this particular institution. Now, understanding that, what he says about these takes on added significance because the churches that supported the college for which he was a professor practiced many of the very same things that we're talking about. And here's what he said. He said, it is an agape because it benefits the needy. Special consideration is shown for the lowly. The sharing of food by the wealthier with the poorer was an important means of charity. The host provided food for those chosen who sometimes did not eat at his house, but received the food at home or accepted it to take home. Question, does that sound like the so-called fellowship meals in the fellowship halls and the gathering of food for fun, food, and frolic just to have a good time? Is that the definition that this man, who has been supported for a long time by churches who advocate this kind of thing, is that the definition that he gives? Well, no. Well, let's look at another definition.
Mickey,
sir?
You can almost infer from that statement that he's basically defining that to be acts of benevolence.
Yes.
For needy members of the church.
Exactly. Exactly right. Now, if that's what it was, then we wouldn't have any objection to it. Now, the very fact that you've said that, I was in a discussion down in Hesperia on these very things. We've commented about that in this segment of the series, where the preacher that I was discussing these things with in a public forum defined, or tried to defend, I should say, his position by saying, well, we have a poorer family in the congregation, and so we get together and have these big meals, and then they take the leftovers home with them. I said, so what you're saying then is what you're practicing is benevolence for the poorer family. He looked at me and smiled, and he said, well, no, it's mostly social. Now, the truth comes out.
Yeah. Well, at least he had the honesty
to it. Yeah, exactly. Correct.
In the 1800s and 1900s. Do we by any chance, I think the answer is no, have any historians from that day, say from Josephus period, that perhaps addressed the love feast and defined more closely, more accurately for us what they were?
I think Josephus had somewhat to say about it, and I don't recall, I don't think I have a chart on that.
Okay.
But yes, I think there is material available back that far. Yes, sir. All right.
So it was separate from the assembly.
All right.
That was contemporary to the first, second century.
That answers your question.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you. Carolyn?
Have any of these authors that we're looking at told what their source is for the information? I mean, what are they looking at that they've
heard? Now that may be looking back at some of the things that he's talking about. I don't know the answer to that question. I just don't know the answer to that question. Anyone have any information on that? I don't.
These
lexicographers and so forth, what's the source of their definitive work? It may come from several different backgrounds. I don't know the answer to that. I would assume that they would refer back to some of these early quote-unquote church fathers because that would be the closest to first century times to get a definition for first century usage and practice of the words. Randy?
Study, but ultimately we're not commanded to have them.
Oh, yeah.
Something that we really need to worry about that much.
You know, well, only to this extent, Randy. I've met with people in regard to the institutional question, regarding the social gospel question, regarding the missionary society question and some of these things. You make that same argument. Well, you know, we're not commanded to do these things, and so we ought not have a problem about it. But the problem is, we do have a problem with it because some insist we will do this. And if you don't like it, there's the door.
So they're going to say, we're going to practice the social gospel and call it a love feast, and here's our scripture to prove that we're going to.
That's right. Whether we use it correctly or not, whether we're in agreement with lexicographers or not, whether we're using the word according to various dictionaries or not, even New Testament practice or not, we're going to do it. Now, you know why?
Because
we want to. That's right.
Because
we want to.
Yeah. I had a conversation with somebody one time, and he said, I can't believe you call yourself a Christian and you never fast. And I said, show me a book, chapter, and verse where it tells me to.
Yeah, well, it's voluntary. If you want to, you may, but you're not compelled to.
Well, that's my point.
Exactly. But you're not compelled or suggested that you do these things as far as the function of the church is concerned.
It's mentioned sort of in passing by these writers.
Yeah. Okay. David?
Well, you know, we're looking at these, and what we're seeing is what the social gospel is, not what they're saying.
Correct.
But we already see in 2 Peter 2:13, it was being abused all the way back then. It's something that has not, you know, I mean, that yet there's a problem with people trying to take advantage of it and abusing it, even way back then.
Sure there was. Sure there was. I'm going to pass over this. I want you to see this one. You'll recognize this name, don't you, David? Guyon Woods. Guyon Woods was an adamant debater on the institutional side of many of these issues that we've been talking about in this series of studies. And I want you to notice what he says about these agape feasts. He says they appear to have had their origin in the practice of wealthier members of the congregation providing food for the poorer ones and eating with them in token of their brotherliness. Now that's in his commentary on 1 Peter, John, and Jude. And the thing that makes that so remarkable is he was associated with churches that didn't practice the very definition that he advocated. How do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile that? You'd think that a man that would give this kind of definition would stand against the social gospel concept because he properly understood it. All right.
And like we ate and then we took the Lord's Supper or vice versa. It seems like it was kind of tied in or something.
Yeah, I'm hidden right there. If I can get past these two or three charts that's in front of it, I've got one. And I don't know exactly how to get to that. I guess I could shut this one off and jump over. But let's notice this. Linsky comments on 1 Corinthians 11, saying that the agape did not take the place of an ordinary meal as the modern church supper. Suppers do, at which people eat to satisfy hunger. Now I want to look at that and let's get to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. This is the passage, Roy, that I think you're interested in, so maybe it's a good thing I didn't jump this chart. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And Johnny, here's the connection with Thayer's definition too, by the way. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, I want to begin reading at verse 17. Look carefully. It says, "But in giving you this charge, I praise you not, that ye come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together in the church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and I partly believe it." First of all, we need to understand coming together in the church, he's not talking about a physical structure. The word church, as we've noted, has a number of definitions in context. The primary definition is called out body of people. And it may be a called out body of people, as we've studied from Acts the 19th chapter, an angry mob of people that had something in common. We might notice in Acts chapter 19 a judicial system that had something in common. It was a called out body of people. When we think of the church, we're thinking about a called out body of people that belong to the Lord. And that's the way we should use that definition. In this particular passage, we look at a called out body of people that belong to the Lord that are assembled together in Corinth. They're assembled together. Now he says, when you come together in the church. Well, wasn't this epistle written to the church of God which is at Corinth? Well, whether they were assembled or not, weren't they the church? Okay, as members of that body, as it were. But now we see they have come together in a collective capacity. And he said, when you come together in the church, that is, in a collective capacity. Notice what he says about them. He says, I hear that divisions exist among you, and I partly believe it. For there must be also factions among you, that they that are approved may be made manifest among you. This verse escaped me for a lot of years. It took me a long time to realize that there are some folks that create trouble, and when they create trouble, it's evident that you don't need them. Does that sound harsh? Well, it sounded awful harsh to me the first time I heard it, but this passage says that divisions happen, and they happen so that those who are approved are made manifest. Now, that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Bad eggs just happen. But when they happen, you know how valuable the good egg is. The good egg is made manifest when you have it among some that are bad. And that's what this passage is teaching. And there were some at Corinth that were creating divisions. And these were necessary so that those who were approved would be made manifest. If you'll notice now at verse 20, he says, when therefore you assemble yourselves together. Now remember, he's addressing the church in Corinth assembled together. And he says, when you assemble yourselves together, it is not possible to eat the Lord's Supper. Well, why? He says, for in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry, and another is drunken. What, have ye not houses to eat and to drink in? Or despise ye the church of God, and put them to shame that have not? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? In this I praise you not. Two or three things I want us to notice in this passage, time permitting. One is that when they were assembled together, they were doing something that Paul is critical of. Paul is critical of them coming together and turning the Lord's Supper into their own supper. Do you see that distinction in these verses? He said, it's not possible for you to eat the Lord's Supper, but in your coming together, what have you done? He says, for in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper. Now, what's the difference in the Lord's Supper and your own supper? What's the Lord's Supper? It's a memorial. The other's a common meal. That's right. You don't eat the Lord's Supper to satisfy your hunger, do you? You eat the Lord's Supper as a memorial, a proclamation of His coming, a remembrance, as we see, of the things that He's done for us. Now, when you eat to satisfy your own hunger, I dare say you may be thinking about a whole lot of different things. One is how good it feels. But when you're looking at this passage, he's critical of what they are doing. What are they doing? They're eating a common meal. They've turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal. Now, Johnny, on the point of them coming together and eating a common meal and then in conjunction with that, eating the Lord's Supper. You see, what these folks are doing is not even consistent with that definition. The very thing that these folks are practicing, Paul is criticizing them for that. Don't do that. Now, if they were eating a common meal and this had to do with the observance of the Lord's Supper, it really makes no distinction because what they are doing, Paul says, don't do it. Stop doing it. Now, I find that ironic that the only time in all of the New Testament that you literally read about the church coming together and having a common meal together, Paul says, stop doing that. And you'll notice in verse 22, he says, what, have ye not houses to eat and to drink in? Or despise ye the church of God? Now, another interesting point, Joy, I believe it was a few months ago we made this point, that as we were discussing the place where we assemble. You remember that? From Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, we noted that a place is authorized. And the question was raised, well, how do we know that they didn't consistently meet in someone's home? And the point was raised, well, you know, in Acts 2, they met in the temple. In other places, they met down by the riverbank, for example, Acts chapter 16. Other times, they met in the synagogue. And we wanted to make this observation in passing, that in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, wherever they were meeting, it was not in someone's home. Now, we know that because he said, wherever you're meeting, you're come together in the assembly, the church assembled, and what you're doing here, you should be doing at home. What does that tell us? They weren't at home. They were someplace else. And they had some kind of a collective meeting place. But the practice that they have engaged in, he said, is a function of the home. It's not a function of the church. All right, Joey?
From the passage you just read, I think one can safely conclude that what he's saying there is that the assembly is not the place for common meals. It's just not the place for it.
Well, that's right. Yes.
Because they were, by everybody's admission here, a common meal. Yes, there were things in place to help those that were less fortunate, but that doesn't change the fact that it was a common meal, right?
Correct.
Okay, so if it was a common meal, and yet Paul is saying, don't you have homes to eat in? Can't you conclude that these love feasts were not part of the assembly, but rather an act of benevolence that occurred outside the assembly?
It very well, and I think one of our lexicographers identified that it very well may have been the wealthier taking this to the poor. So it would still be a function of the home. Yes, Judy and Roy and Randy.
I have a question. You know how some of the churches after a service will have
potluck?
Is that wrong?
Yes. It's not the function of the church to provide those things. Now, if I want to have all of you over to my house to have a potluck after services, wonderful. It becomes a function of the church if the church provides the place for such activity, you see. For example, if I want all of you to come over to my house and every one of you bring a dish and come to my house and we'll have a potluck, who's providing the potluck? Well, everybody that's bringing a dish has a part in it, but who's providing the potluck?
The person that's the house.
That's right. Now, if the church becomes the host for the potluck, now we put the church in the business of providing social and recreational activity. Now there's the problem.
Money out of the treasury, buying food, and then coming together here, that kind of thing. That's what you're saying would not be.
Yes.
Or if the church doesn't pay a cent, but you stand up there and announce it. Then it's
all right.
Part of the function.
All right. So that's not a function of the church. The key to all of this, Judy, is to identify what is the work of the church. Now we can categorize that under three headings. Number one, it's the work of the church to evangelize, preach the gospel. Number two, it's the work of the church to care for its own indigent people. We can do that. Number three, it's the work of the church to build up and edify the saints. We can do that. That's what we're doing tonight. Now, if we go outside that perimeter and say, well, it's the work of the church to provide social and recreational activities for its members. Now, where we got a passage that teaches that? You see, that's where we're hung up. Yeah, we've talked about some of that. And these are the passages that are predominantly used to try to say, well, that's what they did in New Testament times. The church provided these social and recreational activities. And what we're trying to show is that's not what these passages teach. You know, it's one thing to say, well, I want to engage in this practice, and here's the passage that teaches that. We're all for that. But if we handle aright the Scriptures, and that passage really doesn't teach that, then we've abused that passage. Okay? So that's, I think, the answer. Roy, and then back to Randy.
What does the word supper mean? I've heard that from a lot. I mean, really, I know it's heavy.
The word supper has traditionally meant, and even during New Testament times, the main meal of the day. The main meal of the day.
Is that what they call when we take the Lord's Supper? It's written, right? Scripture?
Yes.
The Lord's Supper?
Yes. Well, right here. Verse 20.
Why do we call dinner?
Well, because we've got a bunch of folks that are made up of city folks that didn't grow up in the South. Okay. Don't know when supper is. That's right. You know, often folks in this part of the country don't use the word supper at all. We used it, I grew up, it was breakfast, dinner, and supper. But we use the... Well, it just means the main meal. And when you consider the Lord's Supper, as far as the church is concerned, this is the main thing that we do to celebrate the Lord's death, burial, resurrection, and proclaim His coming again. 1 Corinthians 11 teaches that. That's why we have on the front of the table, "This do in remembrance of me." We're observing the supper of the Lord. The main meal is how that term is used, so that's why that word is used in Scripture. Okay? It could be why some think that, but I'm not sure I would accept that. I think that some do it simply because they want to. And then we go to looking for passages that try to help us to support it. And that's where we ought not stand. When we begin to take a position, I'm going to do this, now I'm going to find the passage to sustain it. You look at denominationalism, what we generally find is the practices in denominationalism began to creep into the Lord's church about 10, 15 years later. And all of these kind of things didn't exist in denominationalism historically. These things began to evolve and then began to be accepted by the Lord's church. For example, how many of you have been a part of a denominational religion in times gone by and you remember when they didn't have a gymnasium? You remember when they did not have a gymnasium. But the same religions out of which you have come now have a gymnasium. Now, how many churches of Christ do you know of today that have gymnasiums? How many of you have been a part of churches of Christ for a long time and can remember, even on the institutional side of things, they did not have gymnasiums? We're generally opposed to that, but now they have gymnasiums. So you see, what I'm trying to communicate to you is that some of these positions can be conditioned. You are conditioned to accept them, little bit at a time, little bit at a time, to the extent then you think that's what the church is. That's what the church is supposed to be doing, because all of my life, that's what it's been doing.
It's the frog in the frying pan.
Exactly. Exactly. And some of you who have children, some of you who are young enough to be my children, you've grown up in an age where this is what the church has always done as far as other churches of Christ. We don't do that here. But you talk to your friends and neighbors that you go to school with who are members of churches of Christ in this local community, and they'll make fun of you. Well, you, what do you mean? You don't have a ball team? What do you mean? You don't have pie suppers? You don't have ping pong tables and pool tables in your building? Any of you ever be hit with ridicule because you don't do those things? You see my point? You've grown up in an age where everybody else your age thinks that's what you ought to be doing. And unless you're taught differently, you'll think that too. And that's why we're having this series of studies. So you'll learn the identity of the Lord's church, and the Lord's church in the New Testament didn't practice these things. Even though they may become common practice, in the age in which we live, there are a lot of things that are common practices in 2010 that did not exist in first century times. Now, we've got to swallow that and admit that that's so. Randy?
I got two things now. One thing, just what you just said, my grandfather instilled one little phrase in my mind that's never gone away, and that is, you've got to take a stand for the truth.
You got to. Who was it said that?
Well, my grandfather.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, back to 1 Corinthians 11.
Wasn't what I meant, but that's okay. Go ahead.
1 Corinthians 11, verse 22, when Paul says, "What, do you not have houses in which to eat and drink?" Well, it's a rhetorical question. He's assuming they gather what the answer is. But he restates it in verse 34 as a command.
Yes, we haven't gotten to that, but go ahead. Go ahead. No, you can do that right this minute.
If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that you may not come together for judgment. And the remaining matters I shall arrange when I come. I mean, there's really no debating what he says. If you're hungry, eat at home.
That's right.
Don't eat at church.
And Jonathan, this is the point regarding the definition. This is the only time in all of the New Testament we find the church doing this. And Paul says, stop doing it. That's a function of the home. That's not a function of the church. Joey, and then David.
Please comment on this. I've even heard people in times past take the position that the love feast had nothing to do with food, that it was spiritual love. That the love feast were people coming together and edifying one another and teaching one another, and that was the point. Had you ever heard anybody take that position?
Albert Barnes. Basically, that's his definition. If you have Barnes' commentary, get it out and read what he says on 1 Corinthians chapter 11. You can find it online if you don't have it. But Albert Barnes has a rather exhaustive discussion of what this was, and he suggests that the Lord's Supper, when we come together of one mind to observe the Lord's Supper, that that constitutes more of a feast of love than any of these things that are done for social or recreational activities to begin with. And I think he's right. Yeah.
Did you ever hear anybody take it as
no.
The love feasts were spiritual love feasts and they had nothing to do with physical food?
I'd have to find that to be a little bit more definitive. What is a spiritual love feast?
Just coming together and loving one another was the love feast. There are some people that take that position.
Yeah. I don't know that I've heard that.
Any historical evidence or credibility to that?
Yeah. Or not. I don't know that I've heard that specifically.
Okay.
David? Okay.
Seems to me it's going along with making sure everybody's physical needs are met.
Well, we've granted that relative to the work of benevolence.
Right.
The church is obligated to do that, but it's not obligated to provide these social occasions.
To me, it seems like it's benevolence, making sure poor people have something to eat. And the comment that was made about, I had read something too, your rich people wouldn't be working on Sunday.
Right.
But your poor people wouldn't be
predominantly slaves.
And so when they came, the rich people had food for them to eat. And again, it's a benevolent thing. It wasn't anything else that was benevolent.
Right. Wasn't social or recreational. Yes.
I think you want to move on to one more real quick point about something that we've been talking about. The churches in time past would allow certain things, but not other things. And that really shows danger of any false doctrine. Once you start teaching that something is okay that is not, then when your kids come to you and say, well, why can't I have a gymnasium? And why can't I do this? And why can't I do that? You don't have a leg to stand on because
that's
you've
right.
already taken away the authority that we had.
That's right.
And so in a few years, everything is okay and you don't recognize it as a church of Christ anymore.
That's right. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference whether you have one foot trying to stand on air or both. You're still in trouble. And that's right. The problem is often we'll try to put one foot on air and our children won't see the difference. They'll put both out there and they're gone.
Well, just kind of sum up Jude 12 and 2 Peter 2:13 are what they're really trying to get across, or these are false teachers, people coming in taking advantage of the church, whether this be a, some type of benevolent action. These people are taking advantage of the benevolence of the church.
Yes.
While they're teaching wrong things.
In both contexts, they're identified as hypocrites.
Right. Okay.
Yes, that's the point, in both contexts. I want to say more about what Barnes has to say, but Chris pushed the buzzer. That's the second one. Up here, too. Okay. All right, we'll stop there and then talk some more about the rest of this. If you don't have, let me insist on this, if you don't have this lesson number 14... this is going to be the summation, the review of this whole series of studies. Forever how long we've been engaged in this, this is the review of it. Be sure after services that you pick one up, okay? Or if David would, just to pass those around.